Welcome to the Snowfighters Institute podcast, featuring conversations with leaders in professional snow and ice management about what's working, what's challenging, and what matters most in our industry. Here's your host, Phil Harwood.
All right. Welcome to another episode of the Snowfighters Institute podcast. My name is Phil Harwood. I'm your host today, and I'm joined today by Scott Lisak from Castle Rocks out of Allentown, Pennsylvania. Scott, thanks for being here, man.
Yeah, my pleasure, Phil. Thanks for having me. I'm excited for our conversation.
Yeah, me too. I see you everywhere. Your face pops up everywhere. You guys do a great job with your social, but I see you at events, and we've chatted a little bit here and there, but really not extensively. So I'm just personally, I'm excited to get to know you better. And I know our listeners are excited to hear your story. So thank you for being here.
Absolutely.
Well, I want to, before we get into the business stuff, and specifically we're going to talk about snow, yeah. But I mean, come on, it is the Snowfighters Institute podcast and we love snow. I know you love snow. I want to talk about personal stuff a little bit, just kind of, you know, what your background is. And I know that crosses into business a little bit and that's cool, but like where'd you grow up? What kind of a kid were you? What was your family like? And then just even into your current personal, you know, with your family, and just tell us who you are on the personal side first.
Absolutely. I love getting into that. Everything we do in life stems from our upbringing, our experiences, some of them good, some of them bad. So starting at the beginning of the chapter, I was born and raised just outside of Allentown, Pennsylvania, in a pretty rural area. I grew up in an agricultural farmland area, playing in cornfields, riding dirt bikes and four-wheelers and snowmobiles and stuff like that. In my early teenage years, I raced bicycles. That's a fact that a lot of people don't know about me. Okay. So I was a track cyclist, the way that like what you see on the Olympics with the bank track and stuff.
Oh, wow.
I was a professional track cyclist by the time I was 15 years old.
Wow.
Racing with the big boys, kind of on an Olympic track, multiple time national champion. And that was around the time frame that Castle Rocks came in. My dad was building a front yard landscape and I helped him with it. And I was like, you know, this is kind of cool. I like building with rocks. I like laying pavers. We can make some money here. Let's do this. So my dad and I started Castle Rocks. And it was, at that time, I was either go full in on cycling or do something else. And for those of you who don't know anything about cycling, it is not professional football. I mean, you're living in a van and getting sponsors to pay for everything. You're not really making too much money or a great lifestyle until you hit a certain level. And even then, you got to get extremely lucky to have it really provide. So I chose to go a different direction. I didn't want that for the rest of my life and really started ramping up Castle Rocks at that point. Have a great family. My parents are phenomenal. I had great aunts and uncles and grandparents. So everybody supported it. Everybody supported doing that. And especially my dad helping me start the business, and got to a point that I was either going to Penn State for landscape contracting or I wasn't going to college at all. And I was just going to keep building up Castle Rocks. So luckily, in hindsight, I got into Penn State and I have a degree in landscape contracting with a design build focus. I have a minor in arboriculture. So went through some pretty good high level education in the industry and got out, graduated in 2010 and really went off to the races. To February 2011, we established Castle Rocks Landscape Company over Castle Rocks Landscaping, which was a sole proprietorship in my dad's name, to the current entity that we are, the LLC, Castle Rocks Landscape Company, which now currently we operate under Castle Rocks Facility Services as a fictitious entity name. So that's kind of the way everything works if you've heard a bunch of the different names that we go by.
Yeah. So I want to get into that a little bit more. Do you have siblings?
I do. I have a sister. Yep.
Okay. All right. And was she involved in this at all? Like, was she out picking up rocks too, or no?
She wasn't fully involved, but she definitely helped out, definitely picked up rocks. Okay. I mean, going way back, we had a rock pile in the backyard that, you know, when we were kids, 5-6-year-old kids, we'd build little rock walls in the backyard and stuff just for fun because we had a pile of rocks in the backyard. Why not?
Is that unique to that area? Because The rocks everywhere. It just sounds like there's, I'm picturing like fields of rocks.
There's fields. So what the Lehigh Valley of Pennsylvania has is called karst topography. It's a very heavy limestone based area that there are just tons of old limestone mines. In the area we grew up, they actually mined, forget what it was called. It was a dye that was used to paint barns red. So in our backyard, we actually had a closed off mine shaft that went in to mine that mineral. That was there, and like we couldn't get into it. It was completely closed off.
Wild.
Just knew it existed there. So it's not like fields of rock, but there's a lot of rock in the area. And with the agriculture in the fields, the farmers would till them up and put them off to the sides of the field, and you know, you could go out and pick them up from there.
Yeah. So Castle Rocks, where does the name come from?
So Castle, K-A-S-E-L, is Lesak backwards, L-E-S-A-K. So
I see what you did there.
That's why it's spelled that way. I will, till the day I die, that credit goes 100% to my dad. He thought that one out. He came up with the name. I will give him all the credit there. And then the rocks was when we first started, we were Castle Rocks Rockscapes. So that was kind of pre-establishing any official entity around it. That's what I was calling it. And I didn't have a driver's license yet. I drove around in an agricultural Kubota tractor with a front end loader on it, picked up those rocks from construction sites in the edges of the fields, and drove around neighborhoods and had people pay me to put them around their flower beds. That's where Castle Rocks came from.
Yeah. Well, before we get into today, I still want to stay focused on what led up to today. So I want to go back to like college years, because that always intrigues me. Like you, so I'm just trying to picture the life that you were living there. You owned a business with your dad, and you were also in college, right? Like, that's crazy. How'd that work?
Ah, man, it was great. it was really fun. So I spent the first 2 years, I did a satellite campus for Penn State. I went to Penn State Berks. And I still lived at home, so I could help my dad doing the work with the company, and was bouncing back and forth between classes and, fully operating. And my major couldn't be completed at a branch campus, so my final 2 years, which turned into 3 years with the minor, came at University Park. And while I was out there, my dad would still do some of the landscaping. I would come home as needed to help. But he was pretty passionate. Both my parents were pretty passionate about, hey, you're in college. Enjoy it. Go have fun. Don't worry about this. The business will be here when you get back. Anything that comes up, we'll be able to handle, which was really nice. So during that time frame, my lifestyle really looked like I was a firefighter at that time, too. Started out as a volunteer firefighter when I was 18. And in State College specifically, it really ramped up. They have a really cool program with the fire department there that if you're a college student, you can live in the firehouse, free room and board in exchange for your service. And it was a really busy department. We saw a lot of working fires, a lot of really crazy rescues, agricultural rescues. One of them, we rescued a cow out of a manure pit, and cave rescues, and I mean, just all kinds of really cool stuff. So my lifestyle looked drastically different than, going to frat parties and stuff. I was living in a firehouse, and at that time was a practicing arborist and had my minor in arboriculture as well. So to make money, I just started a side gig out there that I'd go out and prune trees for $50 an hour. There were a lot of trees, and that was how I made money. So I was still doing my own thing out there, not really associated with Castle Rocks, but it was in the same field.
Wow. Well, I give you a lot of credit for, just getting that degree done and fighting through that. It probably would have been easy to bail, and maybe your dad wouldn't have let you do that. But, I give you a lot of credit. If nobody knows this, there's a really cool connection between Penn State and Michigan State, my alma mater. We were both universities were created by the Land Grant Act in 1855. And in football, we play for the Land Grant Trophy. So we're actually both agricultural schools created by the same piece of legislation, which I think is super cool.
That is cool. I did not know that. I knew about the land grant for Penn State and everything, but I didn't know Michigan was the same. That's really cool.
Yeah, Michigan State, not Michigan.
Michigan State, yes.
Get it right.
Yeah,
get it right.
Big difference.
big difference.
One's respectable.
Well, you know, I mean, they would say we're Mu-U,
yeah,
is what our, you know, they would call us. But, you know, we're proud to be an agricultural university. And also, since we're recording this during the World Cup soccer, I just have to point out that if you don't know this, and if you're a soccer fan watching the World Cup, Michigan State's turf program is responsible for growing in and managing all the turf on all the fields throughout the entire World Cup, all the, 18 locations? So there's uniformity, but that contract is with Michigan State's turf program. So, all right, I digress. I'm getting way off topic here. Let's go back to you. Let's talk about Scott. One last thing before I move on to business. Tell me about your family.
My family. I have a wonderful family, beautiful wife, 3 kids. We are a very Christian family and live our life through Christian values, just, you know, kind of practicing to get better every single day and serve God through everything that we're doing. Mm-hmm. We homeschool our kids. Youngest is mm-hmm. 5. She's almost 6. And then our oldest is 17. We have one right in the middle who's 9. And we're a family unit. We travel together. We do things together as often as possible. Love doing things outside and just, you know, my family's my life. God's first, family's second. Mm-hmm. I'm number 3 and everything else comes after that. That's how I live my life.
Yeah, awesome. Okay, thank you. With that being said, let's move into business stuff. So walk me through that process of you started the business, your dad was there, you guys were kind of partners in the beginning, which is very unusual. Usually it's, you know, hey, I took over my father's business, I'm second generation, and, you know, I'm running the business now and everything. In the beginning, it was your business. He was supporting you and probably mentoring and everything. But is he still involved? And how did that, if he's not, like, what did that transition look like?
That's a great question. Yeah, we started the business together. It was mutual. I had the drive to make it happen, and he did too. He supported it in every way. So we learned a lot together. And, you know, through that, anybody who's in a family business knows there's absolute rough patches. You know, I would say my dad and I have always had a good relationship, but it's been stronger and weaker at times through things directly related to the business. Mm-hmm. I'm just really grateful for who my parents are through that. Largely my mom. She was always the mediator when we got into something really mm-hmm. big, and we were able to work everything out. So back on topic to your question, he is no longer involved today. I've been running the company without him, largely without him, almost exclusively without him for about 10 years now. And
oh, wow.
Just this year, we formalized a buyout in March, which was retroactive mm-hmm. to January 1st, just for tax reasons. And, mm-hmm. You know, we had a several year process. We talked about the succession plan for about a 4-year period. And it was always the plan that I'd buy them out at some point. And as it ramped up, you know, we just have such a good relationship. We're just so tight that it was like, yeah, we'll do this at some point. We'll do this at some point. And then mm-hmm. going over will things and, you know, the end of life type planning for them, mm-hmm. it became really apparent that I didn't want to pay estate taxes on my portion of the company mm-hmm. and didn't want any way that it could get muddied up in the estate by any means if something would happen to both my parents before the buyout happened. So mm-hmm. we really had some serious conversations around that. One of the nice parts for us, we were both very versed in what succession planning looked like, business valuations,
nice.
And how to fully, you know, acquire, merge, do all that stuff. That was an area that was not foreign to us. And mm-hmm. Because of that, we stayed away from the whole process. We never did formal valuations. We never got it. Mm-hmm. We never muddied the water at all. We just kind of sat down around a table and said, here's a number that looks good to you. Mm-hmm. It's way less than 50% of the valuation, but here's the mm-hmm. realities of what the company has done. Are you okay with that? And they said, absolutely. That's way more than we ever thought we were going to get. So that's a good number for us. And that was mm-hmm. how we settled on it. It was really a good conversation.
Wow, fantastic. What are some of the things that you learned through that whole process that maybe you could offer as advice for someone, at, you know, someone else in maybe that situation with parents involved and, not usually things don't go that smoothly. So, like, what advice do you have for our listeners?
Keep family first. Any things that I think I messed up on personally was I put the business ahead of the family relationship several times, largely when I was younger. A lot of ego attached to that. Just be humble and understand that whether you're seeing eye to eye, no matter what happens in business, and this goes further than succession planning, but no matter what happens in business, there's not a right way to do it. There's definitely wrong ways to do it, but there's not one right way to do it. So allow that in the mix, allow that to come in and objectively have conversations that may not result in having 100% your idea work. But if you have 50% of it, you have 20%, it will usually come together. And if it doesn't work out, no problem. Go back to the drawing board and fix it. As soon as you see that happening, just fix it again.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. You guys made a big shift from residential work to commercial facility management work. You talked about your DBA. What was the driving factor behind that? And what did you learn through that whole process?
That's a great question. That's the transformative process in the business. So we started out, fast forwarding a little bit more to the part that we didn't talk about, the 2011 till about 2020, 2021 timeframe, we were a high-end residential design build firm doing large-scale residential projects, outdoor kitchens, poolscapes, water features going into pools, large-scale patios and plantings and stuff like that. That was the basis of what we did. And through that time frame, team grew. We have had some really good people in there. The positions in the business grew. There was a lot going on. I was still a firefighter through that time frame, so I had a lot personally going on through that time frame as well. But we got to a point that we realized right around probably the 1.2 to 1.5 million range that we had to sell $1.2 to $1.5 million every single year to be able to do $1.2 or $1.5 million. Whereas if we started to go into a recurring revenue model in three-year contracts, we could sell $1.5 1 year, $1.5 the next, and $1.5 the next, and that equaled $4.5 instead of just $1.5. So that math on the recurring revenue side really pushed us into a little bit more maintenance and a lot more snow. Simultaneously through this, we have always done snow, keeping our skid loaders and our trucks busy as subcontractors on industrial sites. Anybody that knows Eastern Pennsylvania knows how much industry we have here. And we always just were a subcontractor for a local guy who was a mentor of mine, and he'd pay us hourly to do that. So we got to a point that we saw we were really good at snow. We learned a lot from the mentor. He was a high-performing guy and just really did good work. So we learned from there that how to set the bar high. And we started picking up some of our own contracts, and we started doing well with those contracts. And that kind of morphed into, hey, let's do this more. We're doing some retail contracts now, but we're really good at this industrial stuff. How can we get more in that space ourselves? And that this was around the 2021, 2022 timeframe when we really started making that pivot. And that was when we innovated that to grow in snow, we had to be getting paid 12 months out of the year, whether it snowed or not. We saw how much the loaders cost and the metal pluses cost and how often we needed to buy 20 or 40 of them at a shot to be able to continue growing. And it was risk I wasn't willing to take unless it was guaranteed. So we started pivoting into a 12-month billing seasonal contract model for as many people as we could sell over the years. That has kind of evolved into 70% of our profile, our portfolio rather, is structured that way. 30% is per event and a little bit more variable. But the transition came from recurring revenue. We wanted to build the business up. We wanted to have a little bit more predictable income. And the design build is a truly high-skilled trade. Hardscaping has a lot of engineering behind it,
for sure.
A lot of art behind it, and it takes a lot to train people, and there's not schools that are doing it. So labor pool was another
tough to
driver.
Scale.
It is very tough to scale.
Were there any kind of false assumptions you made or things that you just didn't anticipate along the way, and you're like, oh crap, I wish I would have known this. Or
Well, how much time do you have? Yeah.
What are a couple that stand out?
I think one of the biggest ones is that it would be easier to get clients than it is. You know, you look at your competition as an adversary, like, oh yeah, we're going to go in, we're just going to do this, we're so good. And one of the humbling experiences for me was, you know, we're really good at what we do. There's no denying that. But so is the other guy. Everybody out there, we're not building pianos. We don't have crazy stuff that we're doing. We're plowing snow. We're cutting grass. And the relationship side of it matters a whole lot more than the production side of it does. Because as long as the snow's cleared, as long as the grass is cut and everything looks good, the client's getting what they need from that side. So for our sales process, the big transition was just making sure it's relational, making sure you're getting to know people and figuring out the communications, because the production side matters to the guys that are doing it a whole lot more than the people that are buying it. And that pivot was a big one. And I would say the second one is, I always thought everybody thought like me. I always was like, you know, we got to all be thinking like this. And that goes to employees, clients, everything. And the more experience I've gotten and the older I get, the more I realize how unique of a thought process I have and that other people don't think the way I do. So why would they understand what I'm saying without a little bit more clarity? Those are two really big things that I have learned over time.
Okay. I'm just curious, just as you were talking, I was thinking of personality assessments, you know, that are like DISC or Clifton Strengths. Do you do any of that stuff within your organization to help, like, just figure out who's who?
We have done the DISC assessments within an organization and kind of put everything together for who's going where and who's talking to who. I mean, in a DISC assessment, that really, so you got to have the right, an S should be delivering to a C, not a D to a C. So that's
well, it's just, it provides insight, into how other people are wired and things. You mentioned having a mentor. How did that relationship come about? Did you proactively like seek out a mentor? Did someone just like grab you and, you know, corral you, or how did that work?
I didn't even realize there were mentors until further on in my career for the early on days. The one that specifically that I was talking about owned a garden center that we were buying mulch and products from, and asked if we wanted to plow snow for him. And it was like, yeah, sure. We'll plow snow for you. Absolutely. That sounds great. $75 an hour for a skid steer. We're going back about 20 years. So that's don't get too upset by that.
But then how did that turn into a mentorship relationship?
Just asking questions through everything we're doing. Why are you doing it this way? What is happening here? I'm a curious person. I ask questions as often as I can. So it turned into just getting some of that stuff. And when I outgrew the base level mentorship that was there, it's time to move on to new mentors and get more people.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, cool. What's the state of your, kind of describe your snow business as of today? Like, what does it look like? How big is it? Are you in a tight area? Are you all over a huge area? Are you subcontracting? Like, just describe it in your own words.
So we are almost 100% self-performed. We have a few small sites that are out of markets that we cover that we subcontract as of right now. But overall, we're largely a self-perform and almost 100% industrial provider. We service from the entire eastern half of Pennsylvania. We service from Harrisburg to New Jersey, from Scranton to Philadelphia. Large-scale industrial sites. We operate peak season and winter. We're operating between 120 and 130 people. Have about right around 45 loaders, 15 trucks with ice melt capabilities, and just have a pretty robust mid-sized company.
When you think of your operation, like what? Are there parts of it that you are like really feel like it's a competitive advantage because you really got it figured out? Maybe you have like a combination of technology and systems that you've kind of put together. Like when you're talking to a customer and someone says, "Well, why should I hire you, Scott? Like, you guys are all the same, and all your pricing's the same, and y'all have seasonal contracts and whatever." Like, what's What's the unique thing that you bring to the table?
We bring a different level of communication to the table. And I know that's one that a lot of people talk about, but it's very true with us. We communicate with our clients constantly. They know when we're coming to the site. They get weather forecasts from us. They get game plan updates from us for, you know, days out from snow events. And we keep them updated as we're operating, as we run into issues or have something break down. So production slows down. They know about it right away. And we also have a system in the company that is extremely proactive for damage. If we hit anything on the site, if we have anything happen, right down to chipping curbs, operators will get out right away, take a picture of it, send it to the account manager, and it's within 5 minutes of anything small or big happening on the site. It's in front of the client, so they don't need to find it. We find it. And I think that's an area that's under-talked about in snow. Everybody hits stuff. Everybody is damaging property. So the way you handle that part really creates some long-term relationships if you do that well.
Yeah, I mean, it's inevitable, right? You have huge equipment, and you're not only plowing snow, you're plowing, you know, curb blocks and sod and
all of it.
You're plowing all of it, and you're you know, hitting these properties with salt, with de-icers that are, you know, so like there's going to be damage. And, you know, when customers are requiring you to push snow up over the curb onto landscaping, guess what's going to happen to your landscaping?
Yep.
So they're 100%, I agree with you. I think that's really smart, is to be very proactive about that and say, hey, there's going to be damage, obviously. Hopefully we're not going to knock down all your light poles, but, you know, there inevitably there's going to be something.
Yep, absolutely.
So,
and part of that communication also comes back to the contract side and the selling side, just being transparent with the scope of work. We have a detailed, standardized scope of work. We do it one way every single site that we're on. We don't sway from it. We don't do 1-inch triggers. We don't do 2-inch triggers, any of that. It is a full service scope that we have, completely written into every contract that gets signed, with a map attached to it, with areas that the piles are going to go, areas snow will be relocated to if there's room on site, directions of plow, high priority areas, lower priority areas, all of that goes directly into the standardized scope that we have. And it's right there in black and white in the agreement. So the client knows what they're buying from us before we even plow the snow. And then the first time it snows, we get there and we do it exactly that way. And that leaves an impression.
Yeah, awesome. Tell me about some of the technology and software products that you're using for snow.
Absolutely. So we run the entire business on Aspire software. So our work order management and work tickets and stuff like that all come through Aspire. Financial tracking, job costing is through Aspire, which is really good. Really a good software. We've tried a couple of them. And they all have their ups and downs. Aspire's been the one that we found to really work well for what we're doing, though. We also use WhatsApp is a really big app for us. It's a free app. It's very easy for communications, but we segregate each site, each zone that we cover into different WhatsApp groups. We have a company-wide one for snow, which gets really cumbersome and big because of how many people are in it. So that is just kind of updates, forecasts. Hey, something's coming this Friday, guys. Be ready. But as it dials in from there, we get more granular through WhatsApp. That's where pictures get submitted. That's where everything goes through and gets to the account managers. And you can just, the production-wise, pictures go through that. The damage pictures go through that, everything. So that's been a really good one for us as well.
Use the share location feature in WhatsApp?
We do. Yep.
Okay. Yeah, cool. Now, WhatsApp's great. And like I said, it's free.
It's Everyone free. Likes free. Yep. There's better stuff out there, but the price is better.
What about de-icers? Are you doing any liquid? Are you treating salt? What are you doing?
So we run primarily magnesium treated salt on everything.
Okay.
We get that bulk. And chemically, it's almost identical to a lot of your bag materials that people are using on sidewalks. So we use the bulk salt on sidewalks to save some cost. Liquids, we have heavily researched and are very interested in getting into liquids. the scale of the sites that we're on create a logistical challenge with the liquids. So we intend for the 26-27 winter, we're going to be doing some trial runs on that, in the process of creating some good partnerships with people that can manage those logistical challenges. But on sites that you're running 2 or 3 million square feet of pavement, just getting the thousands and thousands of gallons worth of product between events to the site is a pretty challenging thing that we've been working on navigating.
Yeah, I mean, it's a critical part. Like, you got to think about the distribution system, right? All the tanks, how are you going to set up tanks and how are you going to move things and fill them? And yeah, you got to have all that figured out or it's not going to work.
Yep.
What about sidewalk equipment? What are kind of some of your go-to pieces for sidewalks?
So we love the Ventrac SSVs. We have a whole bunch of the Arians Mammoths. So we like the stand-on units. Mm-hmm. We run some UTVs with plows on the front for them, as well as tractors with brooms and snow blowers. But the majority of our sites are large pavement areas, not very large sidewalk areas. So we have the stand-on units work really well for the majority of our portfolio.
What are you seeing as far as, you know, just kind of maybe the trends in terms of, you know, pricing and profitability on these bigger industrial sites? Are you seeing downward pressure? Are you seeing really the other way because of liability and people just want more better service or willing to pay for it? Like, what are you seeing?
As a general trend, we're seeing it in the upward side. We sell our service as an insurance policy that we're going to be there. We're going to make sure the site is safe. We routinely sell sites for considerable percentage more than what they had paid previous years. And the reasons for needing a new provider justified the cost. So that it's been pretty refreshing. Now we can flip that upside down too and also say it really depends on the client. There are definitely clients within the portfolio that, hey, price, and you get to a certain point, it's like we can't go any lower. It's we can't do that. You're not gonna get the right service. And back to our standards and our standardized scope, we will not sway from that. 20 years of doing this, we do not have a single slip fall ever. I always get nervous when I say that, but we have not had a single slip fall because of how high that standard is, and we won't sway from that.
Wow, that's really incredible. I don't know if I've met someone that has a sizable operation that could ever say that.
That's why I get nervous. It's coming. I know it's coming. I hate every time it comes out of my mouth, but today it's true.
Yeah. I'm hearing the same thing. With price pressure, I there are certainly, like you said, there's customers that have price issues that you got to work around. To me, this is really a sales opportunity to understand what kind of customer you have and what their needs are. But I'm seeing a lot of customers that are willing to spend whatever they have to. What they want is service. They want great service and are willing to pay for it. There's so much liability with snow. So that's why we like snow.
It is. It's a completely different sales process and landscape. That's for sure.
We have a few more minutes. Let's talk about culture and your people and recruiting. Can you kind of, I know those are three very distinct things that I talk about for an hour each, but like the people side of the business, could you talk to me about that?
Absolutely. And yeah, while there are distinct differences, I think they all blend together pretty well too to cover there. So we hire, I'll start on the hiring side. We hire for attitude, not necessarily experience. What we're looking for in people is somebody that's willing to learn, somebody that wants to come in and is going to be upbeat. We'll teach the skills. And we've learned over the years, when you hire for experience, oftentimes they don't have the experience that they sold you in the interview anyway.
Right.
So we like getting people that have a little bit of experience or are green, but have that attitude that they want to learn. And, you know, we have a learning-oriented safety culture in the company. That's what we say. And it's all about learning. It's all about growth, personal growth. I went through a chapter of my life that was extremely hard for me, and I had to grow a lot, you know, mentally, not even within the job, just had to learn how to live my life differently. And I got passionate at that point in time. That was around the pivot when the company really started growing. I wanted to pull some of the tools that I learned and the ways I learned to think into the company and give that back to the rest of the employees. So that's exactly what we've done. I think company culture is really talked about too much. And, well, we have health insurance. We do this. You know, we get paid time off. Like, that's great. Yeah, so do we. That's I don't consider that part of our culture, though. That's part of the job. Our culture is, you know, we truly care about our people. We will go out of our way to say, hey, it looks like you're having a rough day. Are you okay? What's going on here? You've been doing a great job, and this week you weren't doing well. What's going on? Everything okay at home? And, you know, have some of those borderline edgy, on the edge of being okay from an HR standpoint kind of conversations that are the kind of conversations you need to have as a human being to help somebody else grow. Mm-hmm. We have people in recovery. We have people that have been in jail. And, you know, we look at ourselves as the company that's going to give some of those people the opportunity within reason to come back and grow. We have one guy right now who's a killer crew leader. He's been with us for about 4 years. Had a DUI vehicle accident about 6 months before we hired him. Wound up having to go to jail for that DUI while he was one of our employees. Still doesn't have his driver's license back. Still wrestling with it. But he's sober and he's doing an awesome job at work. And he has transformed the person he is because of the opportunity that we were willing to give him. And not only that, we sit down and talk to him. We let him know if he seems like he's off. And, you know, that's just one example. That is one person out of everybody on the team. But we just pride ourselves in being human beings first. It's our people. Mm-hmm. Our people are number one on the list. You know, like outside of anything else, our people are number one. Clients are number two. Profits are number three, in that order every single time, because the successor takes care of it. The first one takes care of the second one every single time.
You referenced having a you know, personal challenge that maybe informed some of your thinking regarding management and dealing with employees and stuff. Can you share a little bit about what that was?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So parallel to this story that I'm talking about is I was a firefighter for 18 years. And, you know, we touched on that a little bit with the Penn State side of it, but that continued after Penn State. And went through being a full volunteer to some positions that were kind of combination positions. And when I got out about 3 years ago, I've been done for about 3 years now. I was a captain in a very busy rescue company.
Wow.
Through all of those pieces, we have had tremendous traumatic events that I experienced. So I had naturally had some PTSD. Starting back in the Penn State days, you know, the way we would deal with that would be, hey, our shift's over. You guys want to go out? You know, we want to come over to this guy's house and have a couple beers. You want to go out to the bar and have a couple beers? That's, you know, what you did in state college and college. And, you know, that continued. I drank a lot. That was the way
we didn't do that at Michigan State.
No, I'm sure you didn't.
No, never. Didn't happen.
But that continued
only every night.
Yeah, that was my coping mechanism, and that really came to head, you know, around 2014, right before my wife and I got married. I was drinking a lot at that point in time, and she came to me with the ultimatum of, you know, hey, you got to get this under control, or I'm not marrying you in a couple weeks. And I knew that wasn't what I wanted. I didn't really know how to get to the next spot that I needed to get. But I knew that wasn't what I wanted. So that was when it really came to a head that I knew there was a problem here. And over the next couple of years, the PTSD really ramped up. And around, I think, 2016, 2017, just really started having some experiences, flashbacks, night sweats, you know, the stuff that really comes. And I didn't think anything of it. I'm like, what is going on? What is this? And talked to somebody finally after it happening for about a year, and they were like, yeah, that's what PTSD is. That's what you're experiencing.
Wow.
All through that time frame, going in and out of drinking a little bit, then not drinking for a long time, and then drinking and not drinking. And, you know, I just wasn't hitting the root problem, though. So 2017 into 2018, I started getting, you know, professional counseling. I went through cognitive behavioral therapy, experienced the emotions that I hadn't experienced. That's really... At the root of it all, post-traumatic stress, it comes from not experiencing the emotions that you had, suppressing them too much. So that was what had to get brought back up through that. And it was life-changing. I mean, I learned about cognition. I learned about neuroscience and how my brain works and how I can, you know, have different neural pathways created around just different thought patterns. And it changed my life through that. So I got through the counseling and really felt better for the PTSD, but I was still drinking. So it got to the point within a few fast couple months there, it got to the point that I had to quit drinking. It was very apparent that it just couldn't control that part. That was the one missing piece that had to happen. So I went to a rehab for drinking and went in on June 1st in 2018, and got everything under control. Got everything under control from there
Good
with
for
the help of
you.
God and a lot of work after the fact too. That was the beginning, definitely not the end. But yeah, that has transformed the way I operate my business, the way I live my life. Grew closer to God through the whole entire experience, and it's been what was once the most embarrassing story that I never wanted to talk about really has become something that I'm extremely proud of, and probably one of the best things that happened in my life. I don't think I'd be where I am today if I wouldn't have gone through some of those really tough experiences.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I know there's a lot of people listening to this that are maybe have gone through that or something similar, or know somebody, or has a someone in their family or a spouse or whatever. And so it's just good to hear and just, hear your story and know that, hey, there's light at the end of the tunnel here if you're willing to stare this down and get the help and be open to that and be humble and be willing to change. You're a young guy. You got a lot of years ahead of you. And I'm guessing if you hadn't gone out down that path, your life would look very different than it does today. You probably wouldn't
Yeah, I
be
can guarantee I wouldn't be married. My youngest child wouldn't be here because she came after the fact. I probably wouldn't have my business anymore. Yeah, it would look very different.
Well, again, thank you for being open to share that.
Yeah, my pleasure. And if anybody's struggling with this, feel free to reach out to me anytime. Anytime at
Oh,
all, look
thank
me up
you.
on LinkedIn. I'm happy to have conversations.
Yeah, that's great. No, and you're definitely active on LinkedIn. I see you there all the time. We just have a couple minutes left. I want to talk about industry involvement. Like I said, I see you pop up everywhere. What are some of the go-to things like you like to be involved in? What advice do you have for someone who maybe isn't involved in some of the associations or some of the, peer groups or anything? Like what can you say to that person?
Get plugged in. I mean that's what it comes down to. Just get plugged in somewhere. SIMA, SIMA. So if you don't know the organization, they have some really good opportunities. The symposium's coming up next week. I'll be in Cincinnati all week next week.
Me
What
too.
Storks does, Gene Stork and the guys at Storks for Snow Alliance, that event has really rapidly become probably my favorite in the industry. Smaller, a couple hundred people only, very intimate, but awesome event. And for smaller people, or even if you're not small, just wondering how to get to the next level, ask questions. Find people that have done what you want to do and ask questions. That is one really cool part about the snow industry that I've found. People are willing to help each other. I mean, we have some monster names in our market that we're all friendly and we all ask each other questions, texting each other and stuff like that, and we'll help each other. If you want to do something, you can do it. Just ask the questions, get plugged in.
Yeah, awesome. Couldn't agree more. Is there anything we didn't discuss that you want to talk about before we wrap up?
Make sure you focus on yourself. Make sure the change you want to see in your business, in your life, starts within you. That is one of the biggest messages I can preach. You're the problem. You're the roadblock. The way you think, the way you act is what's holding you back. So stop blaming other people for that and get rid of the ego, get some humility, and start looking internally to see what has to change. That is accurate 100% of the time.
Awesome. Great advice. Scott, thank you so much. This has been great.
Yeah, absolutely, Phil. Thank
I'll
you.
see you next
Yeah,
week.
see you next week. Looking forward to it.
All right. Take care, man.
Thanks for listening to the Snow Fighters Institute podcast. Subscribe so you don't miss future episodes and check out our upcoming events at snowfightersinstitute.com.